Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August the 9th, 1999. And in Koinonia Fireside Room this afternoon is John Rozelle's session called The Enlightenment is Dead and Nature Killed It. Number 99-2. Let's listen in.
My name is John Rozelle. And I am a PhD student at the University of Delaware in urban affairs and public policy. And my concentration is in technology, environment, and society. And I've been starting to think about my dissertation, and I come up with an outline. I presented that outline and some of the ideas in the first six chapters 2 weeks ago here at Holden, and I got some good feedback on that. And since that time, Nancy and some other people said, well, you should finish. I didn't get to the last part. And the last part is what I really have a hard time with right now. I'm trying to make the connection between some of these ideas here, which I haven't fully thought out, and made a connection to the first part of my dissertation. I'm also on staff here, I should say. I'm a waitry, although today was my last day. And I'll be leaving tomorrow, along with a lot of other people. So I really appreciate you coming, and what I'd like to do first is go over my outline just very briefly. This is what I did a couple weeks ago. I went through chapters 1 through 6 more in depth than I will now. I'll just go over those very briefly. And that'll lead me up to chapter 7, where I'll draw my model on the board, and that'll be used as the basis for our discussion today. And what I'm trying to show is that our economic system, particularly, is at an impasse, and our technological system sort of propels that. But we are at an impasse at the end of this century, and something that started 500 years ago. I'll start with the Enlightenment. And then what I'd like to do, well, now I'll pause right there and see what you have. I'll see if you have any feedback on the first part. And then I would like to throw out some of the ideas that I have written up there on the sheet and just see what you think about them. See if you can make the connection back to the first part. See if any of those things sound like something I should pursue further. Like I said, I have not thought about the connection between those things and the first part fully yet, but we'll just engage in a conversation then. Okay, so just briefly, I'd like to just tell you what the first six chapters were about, and it starts with the Enlightenment. And the reason I called it the Enlightenment, and or the Enlightenment is dead and nature killed it, is that in the Enlightenment 500 years ago, there was sort of a paradigm shift, a big paradigm shift, and that ushered in a new era. At the Enlightenment 500 years ago, the church was the authority. Now I'm talking about Western society here. The church was the authority. They had the scriptures. They had momentum. They had full authority to determine the things in your personal life, but also the things in society. For example, if an apple fell, it was the will of God, versus now we know that it's the law of gravity. So things have totally switched from 500 years ago. What was ushered in was humanism, where rationality, objectivity, and reason took over, and this really gutted the authority of the church. So those three things took over: rationality, objectivity, and reason. And science became the legitimizing agent in society rather than the church. Now, I am a social scientist, and the social sciences also adopted this model. And the hope was that with reason, objectivity, and rationality, we could iron out all the social dialectics that we have, and then eventually set up a system, a social system, that'll be the last one, will be everlasting. That was the goal of social science. Well, in the Enlightenment also, the idea of progress, social progress, was born. Before that, societies were pretty static, but then they became more progressive. And with knowledge acquisition through writing and also speaking, and be able to pass that on from generation to generation, it was thought that knowledge accumulates, and therefore you are better when you go forward in time. Each generation is getting better than the previous one. So this idea of linear progress was also ushered in the Enlightenment. And that led up to, that's basically chapter two in a nutshell. But that led up to chapter three, where I entitled that Efficiency, the Technological Imperative. When the industrialization process started, the industrialists took this idea of efficiency and they adopted science. They pulled the science in, they made reason, objectivity, and rationality. They made that science come alive through the things that they made. And they brought that out, and everybody, it was visible to everybody. And the way that you progress technologically is to become more efficient. And that's where I lead from the Enlightenment into chapter three, which is efficiency, and that I'm entitling the technological imperative. Now that is the way we become more technologically advanced, is to become more efficient. So that's chapter three. Well, I should mention one other thing with chapter three. I'm gonna use Jocko Lewis' model. Has anybody heard of Jocko Lewis? And Lewis Mumford? They've written about techniques and technique. Those are their terms. But especially Alul suggests that efficiency, the strive for efficiency, is progressively dehumanizing. And I was talking to someone on the porch the other night, Fiona. Somebody you know, Fiona. And we were talking about Holden. And we were saying, man, you know, Holden's really efficient, especially the garbage. Some of the other staff here know about the garbology. And Marv is very efficient. And we break things down, put them in different bins, go through every single piece of garbage that goes out of here, and compost and whatnot. But let's say, for example, that we are doing all we can here at Holden to be the most efficient. But let's say, for example, that that wasn't enough. Let's say we are contributing to climate change, or we're making some of these species around here go extinct. Let's say something like that happens. What do we do then? If we are already as efficient as we can, what do we do then? Well, what Jocko Lewis suggests that happens is that the next step, and he suggests we're already in these steps, is that you become less human. You become more like a machine, and you put more requirements on the people. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. If we are to become more efficient as a society, we all have to kind of line up in the same way. One of the examples he uses, he says that man and woman are a useless appendage. 10% of all phone calls are the wrong number. We can't even trust ourselves to dial the phone, much less to drive, to eat, you know, to act in society. So if we are really going to become more efficient, it is more progressively dehumanizing. So that's an important point. Chapter four about growth, this ushering in of efficiency to a direction also of growing. There are two ways you become more efficient economically. One is you can produce more with the same amount of inputs, and that's what we have adopted. That's adhering to what economists call the monotonic principle, where more is preferred to less. The other efficiency is to produce the same amount with fewer inputs, and that one we have not chosen to do. So I suggest that we are on the first one I talked about. And also, if you think about economic growth in general, in the United States, let's say, for example, we are dependent on growth. If our economy does not grow for 6 months, just 6 months, we are in a recession. And everybody knows that big R word and all the bad things that come with it. The media is in a frenzy, you know, politicians are, the CEOs are. Just for 6 months, if we don't produce more than the previous 6 months of the recession. So we're addicted to growth. So one other thing I might mention in there is to refer to economic development, where economic growth now is sort of offered to all of the third world countries as the model to better themselves. You need to grow your economy, you need to open up your economies to capital imports, and especially with international trade, tap into the international market, and pull yourselves up. So addicted to growth. So that's kind of the first part. This is the deconstruction of our techno-economic imperative. That's what I'm entitling it. So the Enlightenment led to efficiency and growth, and I think those two things are key. Now in part two, I haven't decided yet which one of these three I'm gonna choose to focus on, but it'll probably be mass extinction. And what I'm trying to suggest here is that, okay, we had the Enlightenment, it gave us this particular kind of economic and technological system. what does nature have to say about that? And I think these are pretty, these three are pretty strong signals that something is wrong. Now, climate change, I think you've probably all heard enough about climate change. The oceans could rise, ocean currents could stop. Temperatures going up, drought, floods, you know, all that can happen. But I think what I might choose in the end is mass extinction. And this I showed at the first session. And these are the six mass extinction events according to paleobiologists. The first one was 439 million years ago, the Ordovician period, where 85% of the marine animals died. That was before there were animals on land. You can see the Devonian, 85%, the Permian, 95%, and so forth, Triassic. We're currently here in the Holocene, and I'm suggesting, well, I should say I am, but paleobiologists are suggesting that it's different for two reasons. It's qualitative or quantitatively different because the rate of extinction is the fastest ever. Wow. And it's qualitatively different because it's induced largely by one species, humans. Okay, so that, I think, will be a strong chapter saying, look, something is wrong. I have to do something about it. So that's a strong signal.
What induced the 95% one there, Permian?
I don't know. I don't remember. I'd have to go back and look at what I've written about that. Does anybody know the geological periods?
Or not? Which ones? Which ones are you talking about?
The Permian. He's wondering about this Permian one here.
I don't have my glasses. How far back is that one?
245 million years. Well, the Devonian, that's when plants started appearing. So this one was both marine and land, and I can't tell you.
The bar is pretty high. 95% has been wiped out, and nearly that several times. You know, big deal. What if it was another 90% this time?
Yeah. That's true. But these happened over, you know, millions of years, or hundreds of thousands of years. This one's happening so far within 100 years. So, yeah, I'll have to deal with some of those issues, too. I'm sure that'll be raised. These things have happened before. Okay, so that's basically what I talked about last time, 2 weeks ago. And that leads us up to chapter 7, which is the contradiction and impasse. And I'd like to just draw my model on the board, write out some more theoretical things that I'm going to have to consider when I go back to the University of Delaware and face my advisor. And then get your reaction. Just see what you think. See if you think this logic is okay. Should I move forward with this model? And we'll just see what you have to say about that. And then we'll go over here to some of these alternatives and see if there's any other way to operate our economic and technological system. I'm sorry for those of you that weren't at the first one. I'm sure this seems like, whoa, he's going way too fast. We just covered 500 years in 10 minutes. But the intent of this session was to talk about some alternatives and engage in the discussion. So let me just write or draw my model on the board here. That'll be used as our sort of the backdrop for discussing those there. So chapter 7 will explain this. I want to start out with the model of the economy. And this is the way you would get it in Macroeconomics 101, if any of you have macro. It's a circular flow diagram, and it starts out with the household sector, the consumer sector. And you also have over here the business sector. Now, the household sector provides labor to the business sector, so you go to work, and you produce something, and that comes back to the consumers here as goods and services. Now, for your labor, you also get paid, so you get some wages, and what do you do with your wages? Well, you pay for the goods and services, so the money goes back that way. So that's about it. That's the economy. And according to, what chapter was that? Chapter 4, I'm suggesting that this thing has to continually grow. So this thing is getting bigger all the time as time goes on. Okay? Meaning that economic growth means that there's more labor, more wages, more investment, more government spending, more imports and exports. And all those are accounted for in these two flows. Okay? But there's something, well, there's some other flows in there too. Taxes, for example, go and inspect and put those in there too. But there's something that's missing there, something fundamental. And if you go to, if you think about it, if you go to work, you don't just go there and make things out of air, out of nothing. You have to have something to use. Yeah, you have to have some kind of resources. So other economists, ecological economists, have now started to introduce what they call extraction. And that's extraction from nature, or from the biosphere, or from the environment. So that has to come in. It could come in on this side too, but just to leave it in the model, we'll say it goes into the business sector. And then the consumers use the goods and services, and it goes back out as waste. So around this whole thing, we have the environment, or the biosphere. And that is a system that does not grow. But yet within it is a system that is dependent on growth. So that is the contradiction. That's the one thing I'm building up to. So what do we do about it? That's the economic imperative within a confined system. So what do you do about it? Well, a lot of the literature out there suggests that, well, we don't necessarily have to get away from growth. The problem is extraction to waste. So why don't we just become more efficient? Okay, so, well, you can apply that as a policy option. This is called the economic throughput. So let's become more efficient. Well, the impasse that I'm suggesting is that we get back then to chapter 3, where I'm saying becoming more efficient, requiring efficiency, leads to more dehumanizing society. So that's the impasse I'm suggesting, is that we have this contradiction, a growing economy within a non-growing environment. We have the big problems like climate change and mass extinction that are showing up. We have climate change here, and mass extinction. So, well, then what do we do about it? Well, we have to become more efficient. So then you start decreasing this throughput here, but that puts all kinds of social pressures on us to become more efficient. So in the end, what I'm suggesting is that the Enlightenment ushered in humanism, and that has led over 500 years to progressive dehumanism. And then now, what do we lead into? What is the next option? That's what I hope to talk about. Now this, theoretically, this would be the thesis. This is the antithesis. And then you have the synthesis here, sort of a dialectic. I don't know what the synthesis is. You know, I don't know where to go with this, and that's what I'm asking you to help me with. Now this is a dialectical relationship where you suggest that we are evolving into something. It's sort of a progression. You know, we had humanism, within humanism there's a seed of its own destruction, which is dehumanism. And then it's leading into something else, synthesizing into something else. I would rather contemplate today more of a paradigm change. So, paradigmatic change. Something coming in from the outside and wiping out these imperatives. But I don't know if that's possible. I don't even know if it's good to think about things that way. So that's what I wanted to offer you. There's a contradiction, a growing economy with a non-growing environment. The impasse that we're at is that the answer is more efficiency, but that might come with more dehumanization. And also, what do I tell my advisor? Am I a paradigmatic change person or a dialectical change person? Mm-hmm. Yes?
If your thesis is accurate, then our American society and much of Western society would have a lot to worry about, because our political system really is based on the Enlightenment model, you know, as you well know. And, but, you know, there are experts who are, you know, writers who are starting to wonder what's happening even there. Is our society, are we able to handle the ideas that our founding fathers envisioned, you know, in applying them for today? And we are... in that dehumanization, we sort of take ourselves out of our responsibility and role in government as well, you know, and which feeds into a lot of the people. There's always going to be people all too ready to take advantage of that situation, and we haven't become the idea of civility in the general's term, you know. We've kind of maybe losing that a little bit. You know, you come here to an idyllic situation and we all are anxious to talk to each other, but you want to talk to anybody who's on the street in New York City or something, because mm-hmm. you're scared. Right. You don't feel that they're with you. They're all the innate qualities of that somebody's different come out, but they don't. Here's where we can be kind of true to our nature, and mm-hmm. we kind of like to live that for a week.
I've noticed that.
You know what I mean? And yeah. So there's a lot of obviously a lot of contradictions there, but it's going to be. I didn't know dissertations like that. It's going to be a tough one. I
John, the other thing I was thinking about is when you put up the climatic changes and mass extinction, the other thing I think about, especially from an economic point of view, is resource extinction. And what I mean by that is, you know, and I'm sure you've read it in your studies, about people are saying that, that we're within two decades of running out of oil, and I think oil is so fundamental in our economy. And you see it in so many different products in our economy. So I think that's a huge thing. And then also they're talking about, you know, running out of like zinc and copper and some other things. Mm-hmm. But especially the oil, and which I'm thinking with future conflicts, wars, whatever, they're going to be around energy, mm-hmm. I think. So I guess that's the other thing I would put up there, and or I would think about is also resource extinction.
Well, that's what one of the other faculty that's been here quite often, Larry Rasmussen, mm-hmm. he's written a lot about what could be a sustainable community or a sustainable society. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if anybody, you read, I just got the book, so I haven't read it. So.
Earth, Community, Earth Ethics.
Yeah. I remember him talking about, or we were brainstorming 3-4 years ago about what would it be like to have a sustainable society? Mm-hmm. Is it like this? Is it like the Native Americans did for thousands of years? That's a different social structure.
Right.
That's, you know, me as a social scientist, I'm interested in, you know, what humans have perverted out of the system we live in. We've misunderstood our ecological systems, mm-hmm. I think. Is that, anybody else agree with me?
Yeah.
And therefore, by our social system, by our incorrect social thinking, we have perverted our environment.
Okay, can I just respond to that? I know, Paris, you want to say something. First of all, this ties into your comment, too, about the Enlightenment. I'm not proposing to pull out the whole Enlightenment, because obviously we don't want to go back to, let's say, medieval times. What I just want to look at are these two here. Now, the other problem, I should have written this up there, is what I have to decide what I am. Am I a postmodernist or a modernist? For a modernist, I would say, we just screwed it up. We just have to, you know, tweak some things, and then it'll be okay. You know, we're going to go forward with this. A postmodernist would say, no, the whole thing's wrong. You know, we're not offering anything, but you can't go forward with this system that is... you know, just riddled with contradictions. So that's another thing I have to balance. And the last thing I want to say is about sustainable development. That's the current model right now. That's
sustainable development. That's kind of an oxymoron, isn't it?
Yeah, well, or sustainability in general. What that is doing, I think, is just putting the environment in the economy and society, and managing it more. For example, the example I used last time was the Kyoto Protocol, where now we're going to start managing the carbon cycle, so to speak. How much carbon we can put into the atmosphere. And that's pulling the environment into the social and economic system. So that's something I'm thinking about, but it kind of bothers me at the same time.
You know, that we are going to progressively have to manage everything. And then with biotechnology, you know, we're going to manage our own DNA. You know, how far do we go with management?
That's the big question.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, it seems to me a couple things. One is the issue of efficiency, and the other is the issue of management. It seems to me that the question I have to you is, why is efficiency in and of itself bad? I mean, I think that is it possible to incorporate a view of change which incorporates a plurality of things going on at any given time, much like evolution, so that we have a paradigm shift within the possibility of a greater efficiency, mm-hmm. or conservancy, if you will. I mean, I have a camera here. It's very inefficient use of battery power.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was a stupid design. It goes through batteries like crazy. Mm-hmm. That's not good. I mean, I would like that to be better.
Right.
And anybody who can design a camera to make this better would be making an improvement. Mm-hmm. But I also don't. That's not the end. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, is it possible to broaden that discussion to get out of the realm of one or the other? Because I think the second part of it is that development is going to happen. Management is going to happen. We are evolving, clearly. I mean, you look at your statistics about this extinction of the species, we are evolving. Mm-hmm. And we are going to continue to manage and our culture, our every aspect of it is just going to be more and more of that, unless there's just something totally different. Mm-hmm. I mean, we will, Microsoft and the big corporations, we will continue to see larger and larger corporate, you know, global entities arise, I think. So, it's just, to me, it's a matter of that is one thing, and then you look at that compared to up against the idea of the Berlin Wall and how it, you know, collapsed, and how nobody planned that, and yet there was a whole series of things going on under the surface that made that happen. That dissolved the political infrastructures that supported it and so forth, and then one day, within a month, boom, it was gone. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine, Bruce Phillips, once said, we may be winning the battle and not even know it, you know, and I sort of wonder about that. So let's just throw those ideas out in the mix of things. Can we incorporate both, mm-hmm. both those models?
Yeah. That the efficiency thing was questioned 2 weeks ago also, and I think that's the weakest part of this
There are a body of science fiction writers who write about all this sort of thing and what's likely to happen. They try to project into the future, but they usually seem to end up with some sort of a dictatorship model.
Really?
That management is going to lead to one person. You can't run it by a committee.
Hmm. Yeah, the thing that's interesting about this for me, I think, is that we haven't yet asked what the Enlightenment, whether we've come to a different end for the Enlightenment goals. And in this case, efficiency at Holden Village means efficiency for the sustainability of the ecosystem as best we know how. Whereas efficiency in this model means efficiency in order to produce more products to be disposed of. It's efficiency for disposability. And so it's not really efficiency.
Right.
And you're talking about incorporating, and the question for me is efficiency to what end? And is humanism really being deconstructed or monstered up if the goals of humanism are not being shot at anymore? That game has been circumvented by, I mean, we might call it efficiency for competition or efficiency in a model of competition. And maybe that was, maybe, and we've got Darwin and we've got the eugenicists and we've got all those folks working at the same time in that Enlightenment thinking, all we have to do is murder off all the people of color in the world and then we'll have a perfect society. And we've got all of these delusional visions about what is going to, we've wound up with this competitive structure that says all we have to do is compete ourselves mm-hmm. up to challenge ourselves, ratchet it up to a level where we achieve enlightenment. And there's a lot of undercutting, I think, there as well. That, I think, suggests that it's a paradigmatic shift mm-hmm. rather than a synthesis.
I guess my only reaction would be, is there a goal to the Enlightenment? Was there ever a goal? And think about it scientifically. I mean, scientists strive for truth. That means they don't know the answer. They don't have a goal. They just go forward.
Right.
So is there one? Then can social sciences apply their models and suggest, yes, there is a goal? that might be an alternative. And that's where we are different than the scientists, I think.
Well, I don't know. You got philosophy and science sitting next to each other. They're the age-old questions. Philosophers were looking for truth, right? And those things were picked up. What are the best virtues of a political system? What are the best virtues of an economic system? That's part of what the Enlightenment was grounded in, right?
Well, on the social side, yes.
Yeah, okay.
The scientific side is a little bit different. But I think a lot of you are touching on the efficiency thing, and I think I might have to work on that a little bit more. Maybe there's some out of this model with that efficiency.
I'm sorry, I interrupted your last. I'm just looking at this big picture stuff, and how economists understand a society or an interlinked global economy is by looking at what is the economic system, you know, and social scientists look at economic systems as kind of a subchapter of, okay, what's the social constructs in people at the back of the society. I'm wondering, what if we actually looked at reality as a spiritual system, that stuff that we don't even know what's going on, and we don't know who's in charge, and that's okay. I mean, that would be kind of a different way of being human.
Mm-hmm. That's and, good. Go with that, tell me why.
Oh, yeah. Well, that would be a paradigmatic shift, but it's the way I grew up, actually. So I don't feel real at home in places where people are saying, well, it's the economy, stupid, you know, or it's the social system, or it's something that is all these different compartments, rather than looking at the whole system as something that is a mystery, and that we're not in charge and we can't control. Because whenever you set up a whole bunch of little controls, boom, you know, something comes along and will upset it. Totally surprised, the Berlin Wall kind of thing. We can't control all the variables.
Right. Even when we boil science down, we've got physics. They have particles that do things that don't behave.
Yeah.
We have to beat them into strange names.
Yes. So physicists are saying, well, it's the spirituality, stupid.
Right. And so we can't explain it.
Yeah, right.
That's interesting. Thanks. Jonathan?
I was just going to say, I think that, you know, you had a little aside that this was a Western view, and I don't see anything here that suggests, at least from this little overview, that you're really seriously looking in that direction, a non-Western direction, for the answer, except maybe what's up on the board.
Yeah.
But I just have to say, I've said it 1,000 times, I worked in the Middle East for 4 years, and the Christians in the Middle East are very, very happy to tell Christians in the West, we never had the Enlightenment. And so the systems that have a better answer for what, we said efficiency for what, you know, the systems that had a better answer for that are still alive in other parts of the world. And the, what pushes me towards paradigmatic and postmodern would be the premise that our globalized and mass communicationized economic system, which essentially is feeding off of our vanities, you know, the richest people on the planet. We're doing the most damage to the planet by living out our sensuality, in a sense, and thinking anything is possible. You know, they talk about efficiency. I, to this day, cannot believe we're going to exhaust the petroleum products of this planet with cars that are getting, what is it, 12% of the energy out of a gallon of gas?
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to blow the whistle on that kind of behavior? And you can only say, the rest of the world's going to have to save us.
Yeah.
And the paradigm may be something like that. Let's hope it's not, you know, Ayatollah Khomeini. But there might be something in Islam. There might be something in Eastern Christianity.
That's a good point. Let me just put this up. I don't want to go through it, but
E.F. Schumacher, who wrote Small is Beautiful, came up with Buddhist economics.
Let me just put this up there, and we can go on to the discussion. You can read it while we go on, but no, the print's kind of small.
These are different categories, and in this column here, I listed out the materialist perspective, mainly ours, and then the Buddhist perspective.
You can see it's entirely different. If you look at work, we think of it as toil. Buddhists think of it as character forming and so forth. So they, I think I know what you're talking about. There are other systems out there that seem to operate a little bit different.
Well, question is, where's Christianity going to make its bed? And our form, our clone, is going down the same tubes as that system you've drawn, in a sense.
Yeah.
There's like non-Western Christianity. We jump quickly to Buddhist as if that's the alternative in a sense, but I think there's a lot out there in
there's more than that.
Non-Western Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me your email address?
Yeah.
I can correspond.
What are the key modernists would be Bucky Fuller, who really believed you always do more with less, and he always said that, and he was convinced that you could, if you had proper control, that we've always done more with less, so we could always, do almost everything with nothing, apparently, at some point. I see it moving from a goods to a service economy, and at some point, if you redefine what your economy is and what service means, if it's service to others, if service is valued, if we exchange services, we're paying for certain services that people didn't get paid for years ago or didn't get valued for years ago. And so in some ways our system is moving in a proper way of doing things. And we realize the importance of volunteerism and then moving toward, putting some value behind that volunteerism. And so there are some ways our economy has moved and our society has moved in a positive way. Instead of valuing things, we value service, because we know we're going to run out of things. So at some point, the paradigm shift is a logical thing that you ultimately have to deal with the limited goods you have, period. I mean, there's going to be a limited amount of environment unless you decide to colonize all the planets and start, drilling into them, which is a possibility. I mean, that's what people are talking about. But if you take it seriously that we have limited resources, but that they're sufficient, and that what we really need to ratchet up to whatever economy you want to do, you increase the service to individuals, and you do more in service to others. Then we do have the Christian value of service to others can be used as a model system, and say, here, we can speak effectively to that. We do that in advocacy all the time. I mean, all our coalitions of Christian, and we say, we can't speak positively on this, that, or the other, but we can speak very positively on what we know, and what we know in terms of what has worked, what is our calling. What really makes society work is to value others and value what others can do for others. And if you do that, then you create an economy based on valuing, and that itself, if you put that on the stock market, that will grow exponentially. I mean, it'll never stop growing because we hear about love being endless and abundant, but we don't value that. We don't put a dollar figure on spirituality. We have to see a product in front of us. But I think that was the beginning of the 19th century. At the end of the 20th century, you don't call a computer consultant to bring a computer in. You call them because you value their knowledge base and what they can do with that former computer or whatever. You're really valuing their skills, their services, their whatever. And I think more and more we're doing that. And as long as we don't get into this, if we can find a way of making the environmental stuff as sustainable, instead of being greedy and realizing that if we value everybody, things will work better, we can move into an economy of service to each other. And that those services are valued and raised up high and said that works. Because then you're not using up stuff. I think we're moving in that direction. And if we don't, economists are not dumb. They know that you're going to run out of stuff, and so they charge for service. They charge for those services. Things that, if they could turn the sun on and off, they do it. But they'll charge for things you hadn't thought about charging for before. And there are services that somebody at the beginning of the 19th century say, why are you paying for that? Why would anybody want that service? I mean, everybody cooks at home. Why would you want to go out and eat fast food? Things like that.
Yeah.
One of the things that came out of the Enlightenment was this value of the individual. And you can see it a lot in Western societies, and it relates to the gentleman's comment about the Middle East Christians. And every non-Western group doesn't necessarily see it this way, but particularly in North America, in Western values there, it tends to be that way. But it makes it really difficult because all of us in this room, we like to pride ourselves on our individuality. The way you dress, and the way you probably in religion, a lot of you probably say, I don't really need to belong to a group. I don't have to attend a congregation of others or anything. I can have my own beliefs. I can even be a Buddhist at heart. I can do this. I can have my own. My moral values are better than anybody else's, and I can develop them myself. The problem is relates to the what you're getting into here, and that is that we lose more and more that modicum of society, of the glue that holds society together. It's very, and I submit that ultimately our individualism makes us more easily controlled by outside forces. You know, and we play right into it, and. We don't have a feeling of what it is to be human. And this is what the early Christians found immediately. This is why they lapped up the philosophy of the missionary, Christian missionaries and so forth. They really, this was so much better than the Roman, it happened to be the Roman system. And, but you know, the more we get into this, we're getting so much better intellectually and so forth, it's so easy to do this. And yet we can always rationalize everything we do, whether we get an SUV or whatever, you know. And we can, so these are some of the comments. I don't know if it helped you at all in finishing your dissertation there.
That's one reason I came here, is to talk to theologians. I don't know if you're theologians, but I wanted that perspective.
Somebody had mentioned, I'll just say one quick thing. I don't know if you got in your bibliography somewhere a description of the gift economy. I'm only familiar with it from the Winnebago tribe in Wisconsin. And
where you're valued by the gifts you give to others.
Well, actually, everything, it's different from a socialistic kind of system where everything is shared. And everybody owns everything. You know, what you have, you give to others, and then, you know, you're not supposed to think about it, but you get stuff back, too. But it's just, and someone told me at a conference this spring that there are some social scientists that are proposing that the gift economy is the only one that will work. And I believe that this, you've got Iroquois up there, too. I think they did something with that, too.
Is that, I'll get to you, Tom, in a second. Is that close to the one you're telling me about, Paris? The Zion?
The Zacchaean economics? No.
That's different.
Okay. There's a great book on that topic. It's called The Gift, and it's by Guy Lewis, Lewis. It's an excellent book, and he addresses this issue, and that the idea of a gift is what we have in the economy is a series of transactions. But ultimately, if he traces it back to an indigenous sort of culture, as he looks at the idea of gift giving, the idea of a gift, it must be given. And if once it's stopped being given, then it becomes broken, and there's only transactions that are left. So the idea that the way you would encompass or heal an economic society is to move towards the idea of giving or sharing in that sense. And to keep the gift moving, it has to keep moving. And it's a really interesting analysis of
it. Yeah, it does affect growth, or dependency on growth. You know, how many years of recession and depression do we go through before the chain gets going?
You know, it's interesting that Bill Gates and his thing, you know, where he's just recently set up his $100 billion foundation, And it's going to be for, I don't know, did you, anybody recall what it was for? Some medical, thing. But here is Gates, you know, who's basically, you know, gotten to this point in his life where he has the most fabulous accumulation of wealth in the history of humankind, or probably the universe, and, you know, realize that, my gosh, you know, his kids are going to have $10 million each, something like that, which is a whopping sum of money in my scheme of things, but the idea that he could not sustain that one person, apparently, he could not sustain the idea of holding that much wealth. It just almost could not happen, that he had to turn that wealth back to the people from which it came somehow. And so it's interesting in that sense that on that level with Gates, who's the richest man in the world, you know, there is that sense that reality still works. You just can't hold on to it.
That's a good point. Tom, you had a...
I'm not an economist. Yeah, I'm not a theologian. I'm a social worker. Okay. So I come at it from a little different perspective, but I guess what I'm thinking of from some of the comments and what you're showing is that I think of our economy as a competition-based economy. And I also think of it as unchecked growth, which reminds me of a cancer cell. Yeah. That, you know, unchecked growth of a cancer cell, I mean, that just defines what cancer is all about, I guess. And I guess what I think about is paradigm shift, and I'm thinking when I hear the comments of other people here that maybe we need to go back to our tribal ancestry, which I think has a lot of richness in giving us ideas and avenues to pursue regarding the paradigm shift. And perhaps we've taken, our economy has taken competition to such a level that we've exhausted, and we're going to kill ourselves probably if we keep going down that route of competition. And maybe what the tribal ancestries that are telling us, if we bother to look back at the history, is that we need to move out of competition into cooperation, and to see that each of us is fundamentally connected to each other, and that what we do, you know, what affects one of us affects all of us. And so when we talk about like service economy or things like that, maybe that's what we're looking at, is moving more towards a cooperative, kind of interdependent economy. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a good segue into this. Does anybody else have any comments? Yes.
There's a lot of examples and models throughout history about certainly how we can do things better, but it sounds to me like the question is that you're asking right now is, you know, how is that going to happen? Are we going to shift and guide it there from a conscious perspective as a society, using the structure of our culture as it is now, or is something going to happen to us that's going to make us have to change? And I think that historically speaking, at least from American culture, I don't see a historical model in our past that says that we're even capable of that. You know, I mean, we've been one direction since the beginning, and that direction has been destruction of natural resources and indigenous social resources in the course of our competition for what we value, which up to this point is basically money and control. You know? And so we can't talk about how our culture is going to change without talking about our values. And collective consciousness, and what is that? What is that threshold that we have to reach? In other words, how many people have to be in alignment with that certain concept that we need to change in a certain way before it would be possible for it to be an intrinsic change? You know, that's the part that makes me kind of pessimistic about an intrinsic change happening from our culture, and I kind of have a feeling that you know, historically we've changed when we had to, you know, and we haven't really changed all that much.
I think that's a really good point. I'm suggesting mass extinction, climate change, and all these other things in society are the signal, are the things. And then how are we going to react to that? I think that's a good way to frame it. I may not get away from not offering anything at all. I may just say, now we have to react. Paris?
I'm interested in whether, I'm thinking about your thesis and antithesis at the moment, and what is it about humanism, where that shift really is, what is it that kills humanism? And it seems that something that folks are suggesting here is that the very model of individualism that we focused so much attention on is a part of what's undermining humanism now, that we clothe the self with fear and possession, and ironically, we strive to possess things and then throw them away fast enough to buy more things. And it is this constant desire to not only love others, but to love ourselves and accept ourselves where we are. That value that we never take in on a spiritual level is something that our economy keeps us pining for. And that perhaps that humanism wasn't so humane to begin with. And that undermining of humanism is not something that's been eaten from within by efficiency so much as it has been driven to the brink where it's no longer viable by this mode through individualism where a move for community, which only makes sense for a social species. And I think even with individualism, community makes sense. We have focused so much more on individualism than that maybe where we've broken down.
That, well, you frame it better than I did. That's how I'm looking at it, too.
Oh, great.
Yeah. I have it on tape here, so because I'm not taking notes, it's being taped, so I'll take it home.
I think that was very well stated.
But
I want to state some contradictions to that.
Because
okay. The one subject that's been absent from this conversation so far is Karl Marx and socialism. And communism was the antithesis of what you were talking about, and yet it had the same result.
A lot of the same flaws.
Yeah, I mean, it fell apart. It caused the same dehumanization that the individualism on our end did. So.
You wonder if communism, as it manifested itself, wasn't also built on fear, control. Power.
Oh yeah,
same problem.
Right. The Soviet Union was definitely.
Yeah.
Ironically, technology put these systems.
Yeah, that's true.
Communication.
Sorry. Anybody else? To comment?
Make sure you say take pursuit of happiness out of the U.S. Constitution. Constitutional amendment.
Can I call you?
Constitutional amendment.
Sorry. In parentheses, it's selfish to come an individual pursuit of that.
Utilitarianism.
Yeah.
The only other issue that comes to my mind is that population growth, and is it possible to have an efficient, a sustainable efficiency without talking about curbing population growth? There's a lot of people who believe that we've already gone past the point of a zero-sum society, a sustainable society at the level of the number of people that are on the globe right now.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, and the population growth is kind of you look at how it goes and what's happening. It may be the 20, no, I say maybe because I don't, I'm not necessarily a pessimist. I hope I'm not getting that impressionally. But the in America, at least, I think it's true in much of Western civilization. We're getting, if you want to put it in cold, hard scientific facts, like a lot of people in early century like to put it, we're getting more and more of a less common gene pool. We're getting more of a specific gene pool. Visualize that successful people, college-educated people, who are getting to be the real success in any society, and getting relatively small in relation to the masses who are wage earners. They're going to be
marrying themselves, I mean, themselves. And so you're going to get a more specific gene pool. It's going to get more and more, you know, if scientific principles hold true, there'll be a little more advantaged, you know, in that. Now that gets into a really controversial area now, but it's some, I've noticed some population experts are starting to note this, maybe the science of eugenics was so popular and embraced by a lot of people in the earlier part, is that maybe it's happening in a natural way, you know, that people are going to, you can see it when you look, but who you want your children to marry, you know.
But people, when they talk about population growth, forget that the underlying factor is that the individual is not valued, mm-hmm. and their contribution to community is not valued, and especially women. And if they are given education and value, et cetera, they don't want to have a million kids. And the more they're valued, the less children they have, and they value those children because they can't value a litter of children who they have no, you know.
Yeah.
Become part of this death and dying portion.
The new system, yeah.
And their whole value is how many units of children they can provide, rather than the value that they have intrinsically to society and to others. Again, it's the valuing, I think. You stop valuing individuals, you create problems. And I mean individuals within a society. You know, we see it all the time in the Bible. I mean, the society that had the worst problems that Jesus was railing against did not value their, you know, lowest people on the totem pole.
Yeah, sure.
It's almost quarter two, and I'll put some of my cards out here. And if you're interested in emailing me more ideas, I'd appreciate it. But just before we go, I'd like to at least get to this for 2 minutes.
Please.
Because this is where I left off last time, and I didn't get to it last time. The Dakota, let me just briefly tell you what I think. These are some other models I'm thinking about applying. The Dakota have the idea of the seventh fire, and the seventh fire is talks about epochs. I suggest we're in the seventh one right now. And in the seventh one, people go back to the indigenous for the answers, the indigenous people. And earlier on, I think it was last week, Black Elks, someone read Black Elk Speaks in Vespers, talking about the hoop. Black Elk was an Ogallala Sioux holy man, which they're Dakota. So I'm looking at that cultural, or that culture too, for some guidance. But I like the idea of the hoop and circular logic versus linear logic that came out of the Enlightenment Mike was talking about. The Iroquois, Daconowita, I don't know if anybody of you have heard of the great peacemaker Daconowita. He was as a young boy, he had a lisp, so he was kind of ostracized from his society, but he wandered around the woods looking at the trees, and he came up with the ideas that eventually led to some of the ideas put in our own constitution, because he laid forth the ideas for the Iroquois Confederacy, which Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson both studied. Apparently they applied some of those ideas into ours. So my idea there is that some of the answers may be out in nature too. And something my father taught me is that there's truth in nature. And I may look there. And that brings me down to symbiotic mutualism. I was down in the rainforest last January and I was looking at a fig tree, and I couldn't believe all the animals that lived in that fig tree. And the fig tree lived off the animals too. Mm-hmm. You've seen the science shows. So I'm thinking about maybe something like that, living with the earth, realizing that the health of both of us matters. The Kogi, have anybody heard of the Kogi? They're in northern Colombia. I think there was a BBC documentary that's put out on them recently. Anyway, they have tried to remain isolated since contact, and they just recently have come out. They sent one of their I can't remember his title, but they sent one of their tribe members out to learn Spanish to be a translator for the holy men that are coming out now. These holy men spend up to 18 years in isolation just thinking. And they're worried now because they have a legend that they are the elder brothers, and the younger brothers went off in boats to Europe, and they played with their machines, and now they come back to wreck things for them, for the elder brothers. So they finally came out of isolation, and the reason I heard about them is they were talking up at St. Cloud State in Minnesota, and two people showed up. The reason they're coming out is that their sacred lands up in the higher plateaus, where all the rain comes down and gathers, then eventually feeds their aqueducts that come down into their town, it's dried up. And that has never happened before in their history. So they're worried about the younger brothers screwing things up. And I think what they're talking about is climate change. Mm-hmm. So they have some good ideas, I think. The laws of ecology, I'm sure all of you have heard of that. Physics, I'm interested in the laws of thermodynamics, especially the second law that says the entropy law. The first law is matter cannot be created or destroyed. The second law is that transformation happens in one direction only. So if we do live in a finite system, that means that we have X amount of energy. Why then do we have, this is another contradiction, why do we have an economic system that feeds on growth and speed and using as much energy as possible when we know, if we could bring culture or society to know this, and we know that there's this ultimate endpoint where we're going to live on this gray inert lump of mass, you know, called Earth. Lastly, the energy theory of value. This is the Odin brothers out of the University of Florida, I believe. They suggest that we change our whole economic system to be based on the energy theory of value versus the utility theory of value. Now, the utility theory of value is the one we have now, where something is valued based on how much satisfaction it brings you. So Doritos are $2.99 because you get 299 units of satisfaction. Jollies, you get those jollies from. They suggest that we should start pricing things by how much energy goes into producing them and to dispose of them. I don't know how that's going to affect my model. I'm interested in it. I think it would change the economy and definitely the throughput through the middle. Would that lead to more dehumanization with efficiency? I don't know. I haven't made those connections yet. But those are some of the ideas I'm thinking about. And I'll incorporate yours to see what my advisor says and move on. Final comments? Oh, we have another session, right?
Oh, is it time?
I think there's one at 5. But if you want a final comment.
Just wanted to mention one. When I studied Hinduism years ago, there is one strand of Hinduism. Hinduism has different schools of thought, kind of like Christianity in a sense, but there's one intellectual strand that is very interesting, that the idea to enlightenment is to go through the intellectual process. It's a very intellectualized process. And when I look at, for example, Christians like C.S. Lewis and how he found God and Christ, which was through the intellectual realization of it, and I put that up against the Hindu model that I'm just saying, and I look at the evolution of science over the last 300 or 400 years, in that the more and more sophisticated our scientific tools get and measurement, the more we realize that matter and space, matter and energy, there's very little difference. And so the scientific world is also realizing is much less sure of itself than it was 50 to 75 years ago. And within the scientific community itself, there's a greater awareness that there may be something much, much bigger behind all of this. And that the stories, the archetypal stories from the Bible and other traditions may have some merit and some basis. And so, you know, I think of that in that terms of one of your, you know, possible models. And I think it was started out with Hinduism, but I see it happening in terms of the evolution of scientific thought.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.